Good morning. I will call to order the Thursday, February 23rd, 2017, meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. We do not have a quorum right now, so I'm going to dispense with some of the preliminaries, but I am going to ask Representative Torkelson to come forward, and we'll begin hearing his bill, and when we do have a quorum present, we will move his bill, and in order to keep folks on time and on track here with the many obligations that we have for the folks who are in this room today. Representative Torkelson, as I mentioned, we do not have a quorum, so I'm not going to move your bill right now, but we will once we have a quorum. I'll officially bring it before the committee. Representative Torkelson, Chair Torkelson, welcome to the committee. If you will state your name and proceed with your testimony on House File 861. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's happy to be at your committee today. I'm not quite sure why some of your members are late, but I guess maybe you don't have the same standards we have in transportation.
Representative Torkelson, for the record, it's the room at 10:15. You have this tomorrow. Oh, you had it yesterday. How was it?
Oh,
10
I forgot.
Yesterday?
Mr. Chair, I'm so happy to be at this well-rounded.
I thought you might have been. Maybe wanted to reconsider your comments.
And I thank you for your indulgence. House File 861 is a department bill, and I would like to turn over the explanation of the bill to the competent bureaucrat.
And before we do that, Chair Torkelson, our banter has given us the opportunity to have a quorum present. So with that, I will officially move House File 861 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Proceed with your testimony after you've given us your name, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Burdine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And I'll quickly present the bill for you and be happy to answer any questions. Section 1 of the bill removes a sunset on targeted group business and veteran-owned business participation in MnDOT's bid preference program. The statute that authorizes this program provides that the businesses are eligible for a 6% bid preference for only 8 years following May 1st, 2012, or the initial certification for the program. And we're proposing to eliminate that 8-year sunset. These are for projects that are 100% state funded. There's a separate program for projects that receive any federal funds, which is the majority of MnDOT contracts. So this is only for a small number of contracts. Section 2 of the bill updates statute to allow the movement of milk trucks on interstates. Milk haulers have been able to obtain a special overweight permit under state law, but they had been prohibited from operating on the interstate system due to a federal restriction. Congress recently removed that restriction from overweight milk trucks operating on the interstates, and so we're proposing to update state law to match that change. Section 3 provides that certain speeding violations for holders of commercial driver's license learner's permits are no longer masked, and the federal government requires that any moving violation on a driver who has a commercial driver's license or even a learner's permit for a commercial driver's license not be masked, and so we're conforming to that standard. Sections 4 and 5 of the bill change the update for the statewide multimodal transportation plan and the statewide highway capital investment plan from every 4 years to every 5 years. And the idea is that there are a number of issues identified in the plans that would benefit from additional time for us to implement what's in the plan before we have to begin the next cycle of updating the plans. This used to be on a 6-year cycle, and then it was changed to every 4 years, and so we're asking to go to every 5 years. Section 6 requires yield signs at railroad crossings when stop signs or other forms of traffic control are not present, and this again is a change that was made in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices to require yield signs to be installed by December of 2019. And then Section 7 of the bill exempts pipeline welding trucks from most federal motor carrier safety regulations. These exemptions were granted by Congress in federal legislation known as the FAST Act, and states have to adopt this change within a 3-year period.
Mr. Rudine, thank you for your testimony. Members, the Government Operations Committee does hear a number of bills that come through the legislature because there are different government operations or rulemaking provisions. And the area that is within the scope, and as Mr. Rudin gave us the entire background on the bill, Section 1 is really the part that's within the purview of our committee. And so I would ask members to keep their comments and questions for Mr. Rudin or the bill author to Section 1 that's within the scope and jurisdiction of our committee. Members, any questions for the author or Mr. Rudin at this time? Seeing none, we'll come back for one last look after we ask if there's any public comment or testimony on the matter before the committee, House File 861. Seeing none and hearing none, members, other questions? Chair Torkelson, you are going to get off very easy in this committee today.
Mr. Chair,
or so it appears.
I would just like to publicly thank you for being so generous as to allow us to use your committee time for the Finance Committee yesterday. It was very kind of you, and I hope we can repeat.
I suspect the lead from on this committee from the minority party may have a different opinion. He's reminded us all week that we got time off, but he's on your committee. So,
well, you know, if he would rather meet at night, we could probably accommodate that because there's going to be a snowstorm tonight, and I got nothing else to do but hang out.
Well, I will let the two of you take that offline if there are no other questions.
But Mr. Chair. The snowstorm tonight, from what they're saying, is going to go south. I believe you live north of the city.
No.
You're
south.
Okay. You're south. Okay, never mind.
I'm north, but it really
doesn't bother you. You know, no.
Bullseye is on me.
I'm just saying, Mr. Chair, I'm going to save all my hard questions for this bill when it comes to transportation.
As well you should, Representative Nelson, as well you should. Hearing no other testimony, all those in favor of House File, I will renew my motion that House File 861 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Chair Torkelson, you are on your way, sir.
Our next bill
this morning is House File 1001. Representative Vogel, you'll make your way to the testifying table, please. And as Representative Vogel is making his way and getting settled in to present his bill this morning, we do, members, have some housekeeping that we need to take care of. There are two sets of minutes that are included in our packets today. We will start with the February 14th. We need to do a little bit of housekeeping on that. And with that, I'm going to ask Representative Nelson if these are in good form.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the minutes, the acceptance of the minutes from February 14th. It looks like the minor error was corrected, so
very good. Any other discussion on the minutes from the 14th? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And while we're at it, let's do the meeting minutes of the 21st. Gets us caught up. Representative Jessup, have you had an opportunity to review the meeting minutes for the 21st?
I have briefly reviewed. I'd make a motion to approve.
Representative Jessup moves the minutes from the 21st. Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Members, course of action for the remaining bills that we have today are all going to be laid over in this committee. They all deal with rulemaking, which is something that this committee has jurisdiction on, and we do want to have some conversations on rulemaking because it is within our purview, and these are bills that deal with different aspects of rulemaking. So from an educational, informational perspective, we want to hear these bills today. Again, they're being laid over, and we'll have an opportunity to, if appropriate, address them later on in the session. With that, Representative Vogel, welcome to the committee, and we are in House File 1001.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize in advance. I really don't have the humorous, entertaining personality that Chair Torkelson does, so if you find this a little more mundane, you'll have to look at it that way. House File 1001 is a bill that requires legislative notice of administrative rules that on average increase the cost of residential construction remodeling by $1,000 or more per unit. And it also, the bill also permits a legislative committee with subject matter jurisdiction over the proposed rules that exceed this threshold to require that the rule be approved by law before its final adoption. And the reasoning in back of the bill is that I look at this as really a basic problem right now in homeownership, that the cost of regulation is a big contributing factor to the cost of a new house going up quicker than people's income. And what we've done is really started to price a lot of people out of the marketplace. I remember when Laura and I first got married, we were able to, it was a used house, but we were able to, over a period of a couple of years, save enough from her paycheck to come up with a down payment, put on a 20-year mortgage, and actually be homeowners. That's becoming really difficult in today's world. A few years later, we were able to sell that house in the equity that we had built up and actually build our new house that we're still in. So that's really kind of the American dream as I saw it, and I think we're pricing people out right now. Another part of that problem is that the changes that are being made, especially in the regulatory issues, are cumulative. So one regulation by in and of itself may not make it unaffordable, but as this continues to go on year after year, what's happening is that they're well-intended, they're not necessarily bad things, but sometimes they may not be completely necessary, and although they're nice to have, inadvertently we may be pricing people out of the market. And I think what we're seeing really is a critical need for what I would call those starter homes, those lower-priced homes right now. It seems that it's really difficult to construct a home for less than $250,000, a new home. Much of that is of course, the construction cost, but from this information that I found, up to about 25% of that a lot of times can be attributed to different regulations of one type or another. And that's just not in the home construction itself, but in the acquisition of the lot and the preparation of the lot for them. So my concern is that we're really starting to impede the ability of especially lower income and newer people trying to get into housing, the ability to have that first home. So, and then one other aside, too, is I do think it's important that we allow the builder and the purchaser to have some freedom of choice. There are certain things, obviously, that, you know, like in-series smoke alarms and so forth that are a basic safety need, and I understand that. But there may be other things in the way of energy conservation or other improvements that could be made that are nice to have, but maybe not typically totally necessary. So as we look at this, I think the idea of having a stopgap on regulations that would add over $1,000 are a good idea. That's the intent behind this bill. And I believe that I could obviously, Mr. Chair, take questions if you want now, or there are some testifiers that would like to talk to the bill.
Mr. Representative Vogel, thank you for your presentation on the bill. We will get to testifiers in just a minute. I would like to just kind of put you a little bit on the spot with this, but I don't think it will be too difficult. Your background is in banking. Am I correct on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so you maybe have, through your lending institutions, made one or two or more home loans?
Over the years, Mr. Chair, yes.
And so you may have some firsthand familiarity with these kinds of things as consumers have come to you looking for financing?
Yes.
That I just want to kind of establish a little bit of your background and where you come from on this particular piece of legislation. So with that, I see Mr. Coyle is sitting next to you. We'll ask you to introduce yourself for the record and to proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Good morning, committee members. I also don't have a witty personality, so I'll stick to the facts. My name is Peter Coyle. I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. In light of what the committee intends to do today with this bill, I'll just focus very quickly on what the bill does. And as Representative Vogel has indicated, this bill is directly targeted at the cost of building a new home. We are pricing the first-time home buyer out of the marketplace, and we're making it increasingly difficult for seniors who want to move into something smaller, perhaps new, to make that move to a house that they also want to buy. And thus we have a significant absence of housing stock in the marketplace that others will speak to. The bill very simply would authorize policy committees of the legislature who are notified routinely by agencies when they have active rulemaking underway to pull a rule into committee while it's in draft form, conduct oversight on that rule, and assess its cost impacts on the cost of a new home. The threshold of that would be set at $1,000 per housing unit. Could be multifamily, could be single family. That number is a number. It could be variable. The reason we've used $1,000 is because there's data that others will testify to that talks about the incremental effect of a $1,000 increase in the cost of a new home and how many people are priced out of the market simply by that fact. So this bill would authorize the legislature to play, in my opinion, its legitimate role of conducting oversight to make sure that rules track with what statutory authority is underneath them and to ensure that the outcome of the rule is actually a positive benefit both for the state but also for the consumer who's buying that house. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm happy to take questions, but otherwise I'll defer to testifiers.
Mr. Coyle, thank you. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel, and I also have a background in construction, and I'm looking at this, with this, looking at this bill, it just, we're talking about state agencies this would affect. But in my experience, a lot of what the cost that you spoke about the lots and getting those ready, a lot of those are not anything to do with state agencies or state agencies, rules that have been promulgated from the state side. A lot of them come from ordinances from cities. I go back to my mother talks about when they bought their house in the 50s, that it was just the house. The lot was there. There was no yard, no driveway. They had septic and sewer at the time. They weren't required to have a garage. Those houses were built back then. Nowadays, a lot of city ordinances affect that more than what the state does, in that a lot of these new home developments, they require them to have a two-car garage, some of them have a three-car garage. They require them to have all the lots in, trees. I know my brother-in-law, when he bought his house, they had to have a tree of a certain size in the house. That's the stuff that kind of all adds up to the cost. And they don't want the basic house, and some of this is done rightly so by the cities, that they want to make sure that there isn't trash house next to a nice house, and they, you know, that control what their neighborhoods look like. But those have more to do with raising the cost of a house than anything we do at the state legislature. So what kind of ordinances are you talking about, or regulations are you talking about at the state level that we impose on? And give me some specifics, like if you have them.
I'm starting to get a number of member questions at this point, and we do have one, two, three, four other testifiers on here. And Representative Nelson, you do have the question. I did recognize you. Other members, is it something specifically for Mr. Coyle, or is it something that we want to do in general discussion after we hear from all testifiers in public testimony? To Mr. Coyle? Okay, I want to make sure that we're keeping things in order here. Mr. Coyle, you heard Representative Nelson's question. Did you want
I
to
did.
Respond?
You bet. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, thanks for the question. There are myriad state agencies that regulate land development, which is your point. The MPCA, the DNR, Bowser, Department of Health, all of those, Department of Labor and Industry through the building codes, all of those at various points in time in a year or in a series of years promulgate regulations of one sort or another that affect the cost of housing. We're not, this bill doesn't target a single agency. We acknowledge they all have legitimate roles to play, but in our opinion, respectfully, sometimes there's a disconnect between the desire to do something that sounds really good on paper without understanding what the practical cost consequence of doing that is. The testimony later today will document some of those points for your representative, but that would be my preliminary response.
Representative Nelson, quick follow-up.
Well, just the only quick follow-up I have, so this does not preempt local ordinances, cities. This just hits the state, is the way I read the bill.
Mr. Coyle.
Chair, Representative, that's correct. You've identified other problems relating to local ordinance regulation, but that's not the topic of today.
I'll save more questions for later.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And Representative Halverson, you indicated that is to Mr. Coyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it is, and if it isn't, he can certainly defer, and another testifier could just get them out on the table at least. My first question is, are you aware of other agencies where this is a practice where the legislature can stop the rulemaking process at any given point?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, thanks for the question. It's a very good one. Actually, there's a well-established process in statute today. Actually, there's two different mechanisms in statute today. One's run through the LCC, which authorizes through the Speaker and the Majority Leader of the Senate the ability of policy committees to object to rules and to delay the implementation of those rules. That authority doesn't go as far as this bill would propose to go in terms of being able to serve as a hard check, but it does allow for a delay in a rule for a biennial period, which could be a substantial impact. There's a second provision, which was frankly surprising to me when it was brought to my attention, which allows small cities and small businesses to just outright object And based on that objection, as the language reads, they get an out-of-jail-free card. And the only way that that is trumped is if the governor exercises his authority to not allow that provision to be used. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. I know there's folks here from the DNR. When they released the Mississippi Critical Area Rules about 3 or 4 months ago, which has very significant impacts on local development, my understanding is that the governor exercised that authority, and therefore the small community objection can't be used in that circumstance so that the rule can go into effect. So those are two examples that are currently in statute today.
Thank you.
Before I go to that, I just want to let the next two testifiers know so that they can be on deck here. Mr. David Siegel and Mr. Tom Weiner, you are going to be up in that order next, so be prepared, gentlemen, to take the stand here shortly. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually asked somebody else that question earlier, and they said, you should ask Peter that question. So they were right. Thank you. The other question I have is, perhaps you can tell me, when it comes to private development, I really appreciate the focus you guys are bringing in terms of talking about what's affordable for families, first-time home buyers, etc. When we look at what is being developed in terms of the housing marketplace currently, are you able to give us a percentage in terms of what can be considered affordable, what is being targeted toward more modest means customers?
Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me the indulgence to have the folks who actually work in the building industry testify next, okay. They can speak to that question very directly.
Okay, thank you.
That's a great question.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. And with that, Mr. Siegel, you are next, and again, followed by Mr. Weiner, and then following Mr. Weiner will be Ms. Rennie Stone. Again, to keep things moving, that's the order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Siegel, if you just go ahead and introduce yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
I will. I'm David Siegel, and last name is S-I-E-G-E-L, and I'm the Executive Director for the Builders Association of the Twin Cities here today in support of House File 1001. I want to begin with a key statistic. We just did some research, consumer research, in our marketplace. It tracks with some consumer research that's been done across the country. 84% of the respondents, this was a random survey, 84% believe that home ownership is still essential. It is still part of the American dream in our market here. Across the country, we see similar information. So we know that the dream of home ownership remains. Across all ages, across all ethnicities, across all demographics, whether you were presently a renter or whether you were presently a homeowner, didn't matter. You want to own a home. So I think we can all agree that the dream of home ownership remains alive in Minnesota, and it remains alive across the country. Home ownership builds and creates strong communities. And you might ask, what about millennials? Aren't they different? We've heard a lot of information and a lot of speculation about whether millennials' behavior will change and be different than the behavior of their predecessors, and the answer is it will not. All of the research that we've done and all of the research that we see across the country indicates that millennials intend and desire to buy homes at a level at or in excess of the previous generation. There's a problem, though. Problem is there's a lack of affordable inventory in the marketplace. Our builders are challenged to build market-rate, affordably priced homes. And so our builders know this. They know that this is a huge market. They want to reach this market. Mr. Weiner will talk a little bit about the other side of the market and what they desire, which is a very similar product. Our members would like to service this market, but we ask, why isn't there enough of this product then being built? If the demand is there, if there's not much resale available, why aren't we building more affordably priced market-rate homes? And the answer, in large part, is because of the regulatory impact on our industry. Our housing recovery here in the Twin Cities lags behind our sister cities across the Midwest. And our price point distribution is out of whack. Now, I'll illustrate that. A decade ago, 70% of the homes we built in this market were under $350,000. Today, 30% of the homes we build in this market are under $350,000, and 70% of the homes that we build are over $350,000. It's important to note that we understand the need for appropriate regulation. We have great respect for the professionals in our state agencies who manage the rules and the regulations. The agencies are doing the job you have delegated to them. It is your authority, and you delegate that to them, and they're doing that job. And we have confidence in their technical expertise. We have confidence in the rulemaking process. However, we just don't see the emphasis on the broader affordability impacts that these rules have in a cumulative manner. What is lacking is the comprehensive review of these rules with our shared and acknowledged value of affordability and home ownership in mind. We've reached a point where the accumulation of rules, regulations, and fees are having a hugely detrimental impact for Minnesota's families and our housing market. House File 1001 attempts to address this growing problem. It provides the all-important process by which this legislature can exercise its proper role of regulatory oversight. Some have asked, is this a response to the sprinkler rule that's been discussed over the last 5 years? And the reality is that the sprinkler rule was just one, but one of dozens of provisions across multiple rulemaking instances and processes in recent years that have impacted housing costs for families. Those involve Wetland Conservation Act, construction stormwater permits, building codes, energy code, lead paint rule, plumbing code, electrical code are just some of the examples of processes that impact housing. I want to mention that we build a great product in Minnesota. We really do build safe and durable homes in Minnesota. We do instruction for our builders, and we bring in national instructors to ensure that they can get their continuing ed credits as necessary. And those instructors, when they come into this market, talk about the quality of the builders, and they talk about the sophistication of the product built in this market. We do build safe, durable homes. The challenge we're having is we're trying to build safe, durable homes at a price that families can afford, and that affordability piece is often overlooked. We believe House File 1001 will assist the legislature in providing this important and proper role of regulatory oversight, which will result in better policy and more balanced policy for all Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today.
Mr. Siegel, thank you for your testimony. We do have one question on your testimony from Representative Joaquin.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Siegel, it helps to hear you at least expound a little bit on what rules you think are adding to cost. I just was wondering, you threw a lot of them out there too, and I'm not a plumber and electrician, but I'm assuming a lot of those rules have to do with health and safety. You mentioned lead, that has to do with health and safety. Could
right.
you give me maybe a rule that doesn't have to do with the health and safety of people that are buying these homes?
Mr. Siegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what's interesting, I just want to give credit to the Department of Labor. They've just produced a guide to the Minnesota State Building Code as an example. It just came out. And they went back to the legislative intent in 1971 when the building code was instigated. And interestingly enough, they do talk very much. Many citizens of the state are unable to secure adequate housing at prices or rentals which they can afford. Such a situation is contrary to the public interest. What they actually talked about in the promulgation of the original building code was the importance of providing housing to people, and that in and of itself is an issue for safety, health, and welfare and comfort. And furthermore, they said that this is to provide uniform standards, and actually talked about the codes lowering the cost of construction. The ultimate goal of the building code was to, in part, tend to lower construction costs. And so I think all of these codes do certainly address the issue of health and safety to a large part. That's really the role of the regulatory agency that's doing the work under the delegated authority that you've provided them. What I think we're missing is the balance between that and that very important goal of affordability that was identified even in the promulgation of the code back in 1971.
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand you're moving to legislative intent and other things to balance the code, but could you please give me one example of something that's not health and safety? He didn't really in the answer.
Mr. Siegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I understand what you're looking for. Again, in my mind, the reason we regulate an industry is obviously to protect the person who's purchasing that product or to protect the folks who are trying to use that product. I think that's the purpose of regulation. Otherwise, why would we do it? So I think all codes have, to some extent, that role. I think that what we're balancing here are two really vital values, two really critical values that we all agree upon. One is public safety, and that has to be balanced against the very important value of affordability. And we have to recognize that home ownership in and of itself creates public safety and serves the representatives of this, the members of this state. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I guess that's the best I can give you.
Representative Joaquin, final follow-up?
We need some control here, too. Now, I think I've made my point, and your answer was quite interesting. Thank you.
Representative Mason, to this individual testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, because the illustration that the last testifier used is quite sensitive at this point, and it is about the lead. And recently I did get to hear from some people that live in Flint, Michigan, and the absolute the fact that their local officials were taken off and managers were allowing something that was so incredibly unsafe to damage kids, to me, is unconscionable. So there is a real strong thing about, okay, we need to protect the people, period. So anyhow, that was, as I said, it's that particular one that I think is very, very sensitive.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I certainly think you've hit on something. What we often find in the rulemaking process is that it's a prescriptive process as opposed to a performance-based process. I think one of the ways that rulemaking could change and one of the ways that we could assist builders in building the product that we need in this marketplace is to provide a performance pathway as opposed to a prescriptive pathway. I think that's one of the instances in lead where there are ways to do that that we cannot do because of the prescriptive path of rulemaking. And I think that's the future of rulemaking, frankly, is in performance-based versus prescriptive-based rules.
Representative Tice, for this testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably more so just a comment to what Mr. Stiegel is talking about. My husband and I owned a remodeling construction company for 30 years, and one of the reasons why we were so active in it was basically the rule on lead. You talk about health and services. Yeah, it is. But the theory of how to fix it and what to do is very different than what the practical application is. And the cost that is added is incredible, but yet your child can go to a vending machine and get a little, put a quarter in and get a little trinket that's lead that causes a heck of a lot more damage than they have from biting on windowsills or chipped paint. And there probably isn't much left anymore because it's been painted on so many times. But I think it's just a lot of times we feel there is such a divide between what is actually happening and what we want to do that it's making it very burdensome for somebody to do that. And it's added the cost of window replacement greatly because all the things you have to do now and the certifications you have to get. Right. We get it. It is a very it's a health issue. But a homeowner can replace their windows without anything. They can do whatever they want. It doesn't matter. The homeowner can do it, but yet a builder has to take on that liability and do it. And it is expensive. It is very expensive. And does it affect some of the work that's being done? Absolutely. Now the price of window replacement has gone up substantially. Or anything that has to do with it. Go see somebody that's having their siding replaced. Looks like a war zone. You have to have more protection around there. They have to wear special suits, all this kind of stuff. Does that add to the cost? You bet it does. But I will tell you that most of the folks that I know of are doing very good work, very conscious of keeping the work site clean. If you want to continue to remodel, you have to do good work. Otherwise, you aren't going to get the referrals from customers. But I think mostly what we're talking about here is what we want to accomplish and how much it adds to the cost of a house. Now, with some of the new building codes that came out, it's added $7,000, $10,000 just on the heating side alone. That's just the heating side. So what we're talking about is, and that cost does not get passed on to appraisers. So if somebody wants to build a new house, the house does not appraise a lot more than what they figure the house will be worth, because none of these costs are considered in that appraisal. Mm-hmm. So here we are, and that's what we're saying. Let's take a look at how much it really costs, not how much you think it should cost. And then let's follow it through with the appraisal process as well, so that when a person signs a contract to build a new home, their house will not be well over the appraisal amount, where now they got to cough up a lot more money in order to close on that home. That's basically what we're talking about. It's not that we think anything is bad. We're for it. But just make sure that what you want follows through to the rest of the cost. And then also be cognizant of, this is what's adding to the cost of home ownership. And I think you can look across the board and see that home ownership, not only, you know, just the buying process, there's not as many homes on the, or at least different types of homes on the market. There's a reason for this. It's because it's getting too expensive to do. And I can't say it enough, and I've heard it enough from people in the building industry and out. If housing is not doing well, your economy is not doing well. And what we're doing is we're pricing ourselves out of home ownership. And some of the other parts of it, I know there's other bills that deal with condos and things like that. You're just not seeing it because the costs are not, they're just way out of line to what we're actually trying to do here. And if you want folks to be, to take care of their homes and make them healthy, make them safe, you cannot price it. You just can't. It just won't happen. People will stop. Thank you.
Mr. Siegel, thank you for your testimony. We'll now move to Mr. Weiner. Mr. Weiner, welcome to the committee. Bill, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And Ms. Stone, you are next, followed by Mr. McLeland. McLeland.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Weiner. I'm a home builder, land developer, and realtor. Been building homes. Cardinal's been building my name. I'm sorry, my Cardinal Home Builders name my company. We've been building homes since the 1950s, a third-generation family business, and we build mainly on the East Metro. I'm also the Builder Vice President of the Builder Association of the Twin Cities, and I will apologize because I'm not used to speaking in public like this, so I'll apologize.
You're doing just fine.
As a builder, again, as I said, for several decades, I can tell you that the recent regulatory rules and requirements have had a major impact on our industry and ultimately on my ability to build affordable homes. I have developments that I'm doing today that we're struggling to build at a price point that people can afford. I've got a couple examples of that. I'm doing one right now in the city of North St. Paul. It's an infill development. And what we're trying to do with this is build homes that people can age in place so that they want to move into something that's association maintained, they want to downsize, they want one level. So we've tried to fill this need as the existing homes in the communities don't have that. They don't have the ability to do that with the existing homes, so we're trying to fill that need with some new homes. But the recent regulations relating to stormwater rules, building code, energy code, in the case of our twin homes that we're building, the sprinkler systems that by themselves have added $6,000 to $7,000 of cost to each unit. So it's made it very difficult, again, to get to that price point. We're doing another one in the city of Oakdale, and it's, again, the same thing. People are selling their homes, their existing homes, at a price point based on the community values. We try to build a home where they can do a lateral move, and it's very difficult to do. We struggle mightily with it, and we're even considering, is it worth our time and effort to try to do this to meet that need for these people? Our homes have increased in the last 2 years by over $12,000 due to regulatory costs. So that's huge, and that's a huge price point. And that doesn't even take into account the normal increases that we've had in wages and cost of materials. We also know that every time that we do a home, or the cost of our home increases by $1,000, we price out 4,000 Minnesota families from being able to afford a home. So again, these numbers are big. Just 5 years ago, the regulatory cost of a new single-family home was about $65,000. Today, that number is about $84,000 on average. That's a 30% increase in the last 5 years. And again, this is due to the regulations and the rules and codes that we have, as well as the community costs that somebody had mentioned, one of the committee members mentioned. But at the end of the day, 25% of our price point is typically due to those types of costs. I realize that a lot of these items that we've talked about here, they are definitely consumer safety issues, and we're not trying to avoid those or shy away from those because we are concerned about our consumer safety. But we do have to realize that we are pricing these new homes out of range for a majority of Minnesotans. So as a home builder, building homes for families, I'm hoping that the legislature will bring the affordability perspective to rulemaking to be sure that we have the right balance. I thank you for your time.
Mr. Weiner, thank you for your time. Ms. Stone, then followed by Mr. McLeland. Ms. Stone, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. Obviously, our association supports this bill. We think that it is a really sound first step for us to take a comprehensive approach to addressing some of the regulatory cost drivers on the front end of construction. For years, the state's had a policy where we have been looking to fix problems of increased affordability or lack of affordability in homes. And I wanted to take us just real briefly on a little memory lane here, or even a refresh of what you're hearing in other committees. And I just Googled this. But in Minnesota, I don't know how many of you remember Polaris struggling to find workforce housing. Polaris came, and they actually started building homes, and they came here, and they said, we can't get people to build workforce market rate housing that our workers can buy. So they were looking for solutions on providing workforce housing. They were coming here to you for relief, but not necessarily on the regulatory end. We have MHFA, we have DEED, we have individual cities, and they're all coming here saying, may we have grants to write down the cost of housing. May we have TIF credit so that we can write down the cost of housing. And I want to stress with you, those conversations are not about affordable housing as we often think about it for low-income people. This is about building homes that people can afford to buy. So, quite frankly, members, we will continue to be chasing our tails on affordability and housing until we get a handle on some of these front-end costs. One of the things that I find ironic when I deal with regulatory costs, and this isn't necessarily one of the issues that we address by this bill because it's not a Minnesota regulation, but it's a HUD regulation. How many of you think that termites are, termites are a pestilent upon the world in Minnesota north of maybe the counties that touch Iowa? Okay? Guess what our builders have to do? They have to spend $1,000 or more dollars testing for termites and then treating for non-existent pests. These are examples of how regulation can drive affordability that really has nothing to do with safety, but has to do with checking a box with government. I guess in closing, we understand the safety issue. We're working on a very specific issue with Representative Tice this year that will be coming through to this committee. We are absolutely committed to safety. We have the statistics that talk about how safe new homes are. And nothing in this House file will upset the ability for any agency to come in and say, we acknowledge that this is a cost driver. This is perhaps regulatory creep from a manufacturing company. But it provides safety. And you then will have the ability to weigh whether that is value in that expenditure that drives up the cost of housing. So with that, I'll answer any questions that you may have. Otherwise, I want you to know that we really support this bill, and it's about time we stop chasing our tail and we address the issue of affordability from the front end and the back end.
Ms. Stone, I don't have anyone that has asked for questions, and I'm not seeing any hands. We thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
And the final testifier that I have who has signed up is Mr. Scott McLeland. and we'll ask him to come forward. And if there's anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, we'll ask you to just make your way down here, see James, our page, and he'll get you signed in, and we'll get your testimony as well. Mr. McLeland, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I am the state building official and director of construction codes and licensing, a division of the Department of Labor and Industry. And I'm here this morning representing the department to speak against House File 1001. There are three fundamental reasons why we don't support the bill. Number one, we believe it will delay implementation of the new codes. What's the downside of that? Well, in 2015, the home builders helped pass a law that requires the department to adopt codes within 2 years of the date that they're published. So evaluating, debating specific costs of new codes, or having a legislative committee decide that a rule shouldn't be adopted would just prolong an already lengthy process and risk our being able to meet that home builder's 2-year deadline. And one of the reasons the builders want new codes when they are available to actually become adopted is because, believe it or not, a majority of the new code requirements are providing clarification or reduction, relaxing certain provisions. Yes, there are new requirements that sometimes add cost or additional work, but many of them are adding clarity that the builders want as quickly as possible. In addition, it doesn't take much to hit $1,000. As has already been testified, builders charge for materials, the labor to install that work, and then they have to include overhead and profits. So it takes nearly nothing to trip $1,000 in today's market. Second, it's impractical to administer. By way of a little background, our department experts worked very hard with all of our stakeholders to evaluate all the new codes. I've been doing this, frankly, for 30 years, and without exception, we have always collaborated with the experts from the home building industry that go way back. And frankly, it's a lot of work that neither of our staffs really particularly enjoy, but when that time comes, both staffs, ours and code officials and the home builders, spend many, many hours and days evaluating the merits of the new code. It's a lot of work. And there are dozens of changes that affect life safety and durability, trying to ensure we're balancing what's really necessary for public safety versus cost and affordability. That's, believe it or not, that is on our forefront. And today's codes are extremely detailed and complicated, and one needs only to try reading this at bedtime as an exercise to prove that, which I won't even do. But actually, expectations have changed, too, since I've gotten in the business. Homeowners have high expectations as to what these brand-new homes will, how they'll perform, how safe they are, how durable they are, how energy-efficient they are. They expect that they're going to get a product that complies with the latest standards, dry, energy-efficient, etc. So we believe it's unrealistic to expect that legislative committee could duplicate the expertise that's already put into evaluating these codes by subject matter experts on all sides of the issue. For example, until the late 1990s, foundation basements were collapsing, failing, bending due to inadequate codes and enforcement on them. We're talking about controlling indoor air ventilation so moisture and mold isn't formed. We're talking about discovering the cause for thousands of dollars lost in damaged homes due to inadequate stucco code some 10 years ago. And we're talking about properly braced walls and roof trusses so that the first straight line wind we experienced this spring, corners haven't been cut and the walls get pushed off the foundations. So these are serious issues that we do take seriously. And lastly, we believe it's not necessary. And it's been pointed out, and frankly, I think emphasized, the fact that we are concerned with affordability. Our statute that governs what we adopt and including codes actually states, in part, that it tends to lower construction costs. And the construction of buildings should be permitted at the least possible cost consistent with recognized standards of health and safety. We are committed to that. And we do recognize that this bill is an honest attempt to try to control the cost of new home construction. But we also believe that there exists a fairly comprehensive rulemaking process that already requires an economic analysis on the potential cost of any proposed rule based on any amount of increase. And between our experts, between our legal counsel, we provide a very detailed analysis of every change that goes into the code. So in closing, most of the provisions we put into the building code have been thoroughly vetted, discussed by all the stakeholders involved. Some add cost, most do not, frankly. But we believe to add yet another step in an already very, very complex adoption process really undermines the work that all the stakeholders put in behind the scenes to try to make this right. And if someone is aggrieved by an issue, there is a public hearing process that everybody can avail themselves of. And we don't always have requests for a public hearing. So with that, I am more than happy to take any question that anybody might have.
Mr. Cullen, first, my apologies for mispronouncing your name earlier. Oh. And I do have a member question on the list. Representative Jessup, and then I see Representative Mason, you will follow.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Cullen. Clearly, the builders are here today because they have a concern. They have a concern with regulation, and they're frustrated. They're seeing that there's higher costs involved. From a consumer standpoint, we want people to be building homes. If this bill were not put in place, what can the agency offer to reduce this issue and this crisis today? What can be done, from your perspective, to lower the cost of regulations for the builders and make homes more affordable? What would be some alternatives?
That's a good question, Representative. Mr. Chair. One thing we have already, first of all, let me just clarify that has already been testified. There's three major components to the skyrocketing cost of construction. Land. It's almost cost prohibitive in the Twin Cities to build something affordable, frankly. Two is labor. And three are all the regulations, of which environmental, and yes, building codes play a small part in that, a part. We have already introduced to an existing advisory board called the Construction Codes Advisory Council that beginning next year, when we start evaluating the next series of codes for adoption, that we will manage work groups in each of these different disciplines. And I have committed to the group and to our stakeholders that every single change that gets included in a new edition of the national code will have eyes put on it. And as a group of stakeholders and code people, we will evaluate those together so that if there is something that increased costs, we'll all be dealing with it together. Well, that's probably the biggest change that we're trying to make.
Okay. Representative Jessup, follow-up? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was on the City Council, we had a lot of construction going on in the city. And I can tell you, I was going to write a book at one point about how many homes were major problems. I can remember one, again, new house. Every time it had a major rain, there was water coming into the kitchen. And the contractor said, well, you need to let the house settle. Eventually, yeah. They got into lawsuits, et cetera. So a lot of the codes we have are not really protecting the homeowners in the first place. So that's but another story is, can you please give us some background on the termite code? That one I find intriguing. Thank you.
Representative Mason, Mr. Chair.
Go on.
I'm not familiar with that provision. If there is something in our code, we adopt these national codes, and oftentimes there are geographic maps throughout the United States as to what our snow loads should be or wind loads or maybe a frost level or termite where that is. We are able to establish that by rule as we see fit for our state. So if that's out of whack, by all means, that's something we can address and repair in rulemaking.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions by members? Representative Nelson. I've got Peterson and then Nelson. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, for bringing up this bill. This has been a concern that I have been dealing with as well. And Mr. McClellan, you said that delaying implementation of the codes was problematic. And I guess that, you know, if you want to provide more clarity, I personally feel that a public forum such as this will probably add the transparency that we need. And, you know, your book is 2 inches thick. So mm-hmm. There are certainly plenty of rules, it looks like, available already. And I guess following up on Representative Jessup's comments, you know, maybe there should be a little bit more of a process with the stakeholder groups looking at which codes maybe aren't quite as relevant any longer, so that we really can look at addressing the increased costs of building. It is hindering economic growth, and in the communities that Representative Mason and I share in Burnsville, there are many, many homes that were built in the 60s, and quite frankly, they need to be updated. And many of these young millennial families are starting to do that, but if we continue to have additional regulatory burdens on these families, it makes it less and less attainable for them to improve their homes, increase economic vitality, and then, you know, make sure that, that people are living in the types of homes that they really prefer, and be able to provide housing that is affordable for everyone. So that's why we feel like this might be a better approach, so that we can lower those costs for everyone, so everyone has an opportunity to live in their own home. So I would just encourage you to continue to work with the trade groups. Of course, you know, just because it's not in your book doesn't mean that you can't talk about some best practices that you're finding through your work. Mm-hmm. And I just encourage you to continue to keep those communication lines open. Thank you.
Representative Pearson well stated those are going to be my closing thoughts, and I don't have to make them later today. Mr. McLeland, any comments on that? And then I'm going to go to Representative Nelson, and then I will again take any public testimony. We do have four other bills that we need to get done before noon today, and I don't want to rush the matter, but we do have
certainly
a layover. We're not moving these out of committee, so this is not the last time
certainly
that we'll have a chance to discuss this. Very quickly, sir. Any comments to Representative?
I would just say I do appreciate your comments, Representative, and as a father of four grown children that have tried to get into homes, and two of the three have, I struggle with that as well. I can say that our staff, and you'd have to believe me when I say we have made numerous changes, especially in the existing home market, where the national code says you can't occupy a space unless it has a certain ceiling height. We've reduced that, recognizing the homes in some built-up areas we'll never achieve that, and putting in egress windows and some other things. So we are very sensitive to that, and yet I do hear you that we need to continue to work with our stakeholders so these are all vetted. Thank you.
Representative Nelson, you are next on the
chair. I'll be quick here. I mean, I think this bill is getting at, it's making it easier to attack the codes and blaming them for all of the problems of affordability and housing, and it doesn't get at any of the major costs of that. Lot prices, the market. I mean, and real estate agents tell you what's the biggest determining factor in what the cost of a home is. It's three things: location, 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 and everything else being equal, where the house is where it's what's going to be the cost of it. Also, the cost of housing. Again, I bring up my mother. My mother's house, when she bought it 10 years ago, it was at one price, and it went up to the house across the street from hers, which was identical to hers, before the housing bust, sold for $200,000. After the housing bust, that price of that house went down to under $150,000. And they're creeping back up again. And that has nothing to do, that's an existing house, that has nothing to do with the codes or how it was built or any of the new codes that are there. A lot of this is market driven. Right now, there's a limit to the number of houses, affordable housing, and as was pointed out here, that lot prices, you can't build a house in the metro area that's affordable when you could buy. First, you got to buy the lot, and that's more the most of the cost of it. So, I mean, a lot of these things, I think these are, this, you know, we look at rulemaking and we look at the building codes. We do this all the time. We're not going to change that here. And if we're hearing, listening to this, there aren't very many of us here that are experts on building, and the building codes are, when they go over those through the rulemaking process, they have experts that review those. So it's a matter of, I think this bill is going it the wrong way, but I'm with that, that's a comment, and we'll go from there.
Representative Tice, final follow-up, and I'm going to give you a very short latitude because we do need to get public testimony as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that when he holds up that book, that 2-inch book, my employees have to know that book. And a lot of what they have to do, they don't have a lot of input in. The codes are needed, yes, but I think there's a lot of excessive requests of what we have to do. A lot of it goes above and beyond what Minnesota has always done, because we're looked at across the nation at what the code is. And Minnesota does a wonderful job on many different things, but yet we still have to do the percentages they see that need to happen across the nation. There's a lot of interpretations like that, but I think what we really feel is a lot of times what we're having to deal with, and yes, they do get vetted, but I would say sometimes we aren't seeing a lot of thought between the theory and the application of how much it really costs. And so what we really want to say is let's look at Minnesota as Minnesota is, not as what Alabama's doing in Louisiana and Florida. They don't do a really great job of insulating and things like that. Minnesota is probably second in the nation, just short of Alaska, in what we do. There's a lot of things that we do great, and I think what we're seeing is just such an excess, and the codes get to be very burdensome. And, yeah, when he holds up that book, every single one of my employees has to know what's in that book. So we aren't in favor of it, and I don't think neither is the department. So when I hear talk of let's do a better job of doing this together, I'm all for that, and I think that's what we've been trying to do for years. Thank you.
Is there any member from the public that wants to testify who has not had a chance to testify on House File 1001 that is before the committee at this point? Seeing none and hearing none, I will lay over House File 1001 for future consideration. Thank you for your time. Members, thank you for your questions. Representative Green, we will be taking your bill next. Again, in our theme today, we're going to be laying over House File 552 for future consideration. Representative Green, welcome to the committee. I will ask you to go ahead and state your name and then present your bill, and we'll take any testifiers that you may have as well as others that have signed up. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Representative Steve Green, and I guess I'll have to have somebody move my bill.
I've already done that. We're laying it over, so I've acknowledged that that's our path for today. So welcome again and proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 552 is a rule that is a bill that deals with rules as well, and hopefully if a bill like mine passes, we will eliminate the controversy that you see here today, because we'll be dealing with it on the front end. The first part of the bill talks about specific rule making authority, which would limit the rules that we allow the agencies to make to the specific projects that they are doing. It does not eliminate the expedited rules, the ones that deal with safety and those things. And on the second half of the bill, on page 2, it reduces the number of people that would request a public hearing for the repealing of rules down to 25 from 100. And then the last part of the bill in section 3 would require the agencies to bring us a list of the rules and by what authority that they were there. And it would also require the rules to not go on into the future. Would not affect the rules that are already there, but the new rules that they are coming up with would end with the authority of the one that they were granted for. And it also deals with the obsolete rules portion of the bill as well, and I will make every attempt to stand for questions on this.
Thank you, Representative Green. Members, questions for Representative Green on the bill? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess if this bill goes into effect, what happens to rules that we already have in effect that were granted under more general authority? I mean, would they go away and have to go through the process again, or would they still stay in effect? And you mentioned rules would end with the authority going forward. Well, give me an example of what you're talking about. With what rules do we, so we have a rule, say, on for the DNR on water use or what protection of our waterways. When does that expire? When would that expire, the authority or the need for that rule to protect our waterways? Because that doesn't change today or tomorrow. We still want to protect our waterways 20, 40, 30, 40 years in the future. So what are you talking about there?
Okay. As I understand, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and I gave what my proposals were to staff, because obviously I'm not an expert on the rules, but as I understand it, as long as the authority that was granted to the agency to do that specific task was in place, they would have the rule would stay in effect. But just like now, if the statute goes away, that's existing law, if the statute goes away, then the rule goes away. And as far as the rules going back, the ones that are already in place, I have got that question, and someone had a concern about that, and I think I've addressed that in here. If you look at line 2.17, it starts on 2.16. Starting at, a grant of rulemaking authority is presumed invalid for purposes of adopting future rules if the authority is not cited in the report required by this section.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
So, Mr. Chair, and I get, Representative Green, I know I've dealt with rulemaking before. I know we've gone, and we did a few years back, we did a big overhaul and streamlining and of the rulemaking process, and rules to go forward, the reports that we get back from the office, the Office of Administrative Hearings, that when they go forward with the rules, that one of the things they look at, and every rule that is proposed by any agency, is whether it's within their authority to do that, and if it's not within their authority or beyond their authority, they're not allowed for those rules to go forward. And oftentimes we get those reports back saying they deny this part of the rule because they don't have the authority to do that. So we're already doing that. So, I mean, how would this change that process and make it better?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, this is designed, and the part that's in here now was dealing. The reason I put the rules to not go back is because there's a whole lot of rules that we can't eliminate, even though I would like to go through them all. But I do want to, in the first part of Section 3, is go through the rules that are there, but they would have to be required to give us a report, because that's our job. I mean, we are elected to make laws. And what I think has happened is, over the course of quite a few years, we have allowed rulemaking authority to go forward and then not done a really good job as to see if those rules are still valid. And I do know that they can be looked at, but there's an awful lot of them. And this is our job. So the portion that is important here is that we're going to be getting reports, and the legislature is going to have to go through those and see on those previous rules if they're still valid or not. And then the other part of it, what you're talking about, I believe, for the rules going forward into the future, is that we won't go back until those rules are looked at. And we won't eliminate those rules until they're looked at.
Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, and again, I believe the Chair has seen those reports. I know I've gotten those reports as being on both the Chair of this committee and being the lead of this committee, that every year our agencies do that. They go and they come forward with a report that says these are the rules that are obsolete that we're going to eliminate, and these are what we may propose as rules. But we get that. They do that every year. So, Mr. Chair, well, I'll just leave it at that. As we can discuss this further going forward when
Representative Green follow
Mr.
up
Chair,
on that.
I understand they do that on the rules that they're proposing to change. What this would do was give us a list of the rules that they have and by what authority that they get receive them, and then we can decide if they're still valid.
Before I go back to member questions, I'm going to ask that Mr. Kirk Kudela, if he is here today and would like to come forward from the Department of the PCA. Sir, welcome, and state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kudela. I am the Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The agencies have consolidated their concerns with the bill, so you would only hear from one agency representative to save and respect the time of the committee. So I'm here on behalf of not only the agency but other agencies, and do have concerns in opposition to the bill. Our first starts with the Section 1, wondering what is the standards for specificity. There's a few different ways that the rule could be read. Does it require individual rulemaking to begin only in response to specific legislation each time? Does it require that for some general rulemaking, such as MPCA and Department of Health under the Clean Water Act, when we look to create a standard for a specific type of toxic substance, does that specific standard or chemical need to be in the rule? An example would be PFCs that we are dealing with in the East Metropolitan Area and the rest of the nation are. Would we have to come and get legislative authority before we could look into those issues that are affecting drinking water? Both those standards have concerns because they slow down an agency's ability to react in a timely manner to make critical decisions on regulations, worker safety standards, or even DNR hunting and fishing seasons. We're also concerned about if the rulemaking authority is too specific and a rule going through the process that was talked about earlier where we work with stakeholders, what if it no longer fits those side rails? What if the flexibility that is being requested of the stakeholders and the agency don't fit there? Would the agency need to come back and pass another, get another law passed to allow for those changes when it makes common sense to all those involved? We also have concerns about times when there is general authority given to agencies because of federal delegation. And an example is the Clean Water Act, and the MPCA has that authority to make sure we have our delegation, which allows for us to do permits in Minnesota with folks in St. Paul and our regional offices versus EPA, Chicago, and D.C. At times, we must change our rules or plans to keep up with that delegation, and there are times then where we risk losing that authority as a result of inaction or sanctions. For instance, on non-attainment for air quality, additional permit requirements could be put on the state or loss of highway funding. We do have a question also about a rule that was created under general authority and then with the law change talking about specific authority. If the agency goes back to make a change to that rule, how would that mechanism work as a result of the change in Section 1? Section 2, we have questions about what is the problem that it's trying to solve. We have not heard of any concerns about the 100-person threshold for expedited rulemaking. Expedited rulemaking is given by the legislature in very small amount of times, and specifically the statute on the top says it can only be used if the legislature has specifically referenced this section of statute. So our concern is, what is the issue that we are trying to solve here? Number three, Section 3 deals with the report. As mentioned earlier by Representative Nelson, every time an agency goes before to look at potentially changing its rules, it needs to put together a statement of need and reasonableness, as reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings, to make sure that the agency is staying within the side rails that have been put forward by the legislature in the authorizing legislation. We do have some concerns about the report. It sets up a couple problems. One is a gotcha situation, where if the agency inadvertently left off a rulemaking in the report, it now loses that ability because of a clerical error. The legislative authority is now removed. We also have concerns about new rulemaking. This appears to be a one-time report in session law that will be done in 2017. If the legislature requires and gives agencies new rulemaking authority, how does that play into the issue, since the sentences on 2.16 to 2.18 restrict the agency to rulemaking that is only in the report? So there's a number of questions that we have with the law, and a lot of it comes down to the impact and us following what the legislature has presented to the agencies to carry out the specifics to the general policy the legislature creates. Thank you, Chair, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm just going to ask you to stand by because I'm going to go with public testimony. We do have a couple member questions, and we'll maybe some of them will come to you, and we'll just ask you to kind of stand by. Is there anyone else in the audience today that would like to testify on the matter before the committee on House File 552? Anyone wishing to testify on House File 552? With that, Mr. Representative Green, we'll give you the word before we go to member questions.
Okay. Just maybe can answer some questions that he is going to be bringing up or has brought up. The specific authority would be for what we pass in law. So if we pass in law, pass a law, and they need authority to implement that certain law, that is there. If you look in the section of my bill, 1.13, and I do not have the book with me, so I can't cite the rule specifically. But it says, except as provided in sections 14.388 and 14.3895. They will still retain those rules. And those rules deal with, they can do it with unnecessary rules there without our approval. They can deal with any immediate threat. They can deal with any court orders. They can deal with any changes that changes in interpretation of the law, basically. So if the law changes, they can deal with that. And they can also deal with changes that don't affect the rule. The other part of that, the 1.389, is a deal for, or is a rule for eliminating unnecessary rules. So the concerns that they had are dealt with in this bill. If there's an emergency or if there's another law that comes down, even from the federal agencies, as I understand it, they have that authority, but it would be a temporary authority, and it would last for only a certain amount of time, and then they would either have to come back and get that authorized through the state if they still needed it, or it would eventually go away. On page 2, subdivision 1, or, you know, starting at 2.1, the only reason for lowering that from 100 requests to 25 is because as I was reading through these rules, and I did read through them, this was the only place that still required 100. And everything else was at 25, so that makes that coincide with the rest of the bill. And as far as the rest, yeah, it's going to be cumbersome for them to bring these rules forward. But again, that's why we're here. That's why we were elected. We have the election certificates, and we answer to the people. And the agencies answer to us. And so I think it's important that this move forward.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one quick question I'd have for the author, and then maybe just a comment after that. In Statute 14.05, which you reference in your bill, the agencies are already required to do, and I was glad to hear this because it was brought up in with the last bill and the testifier. At the end of every year, they're required to do a report on the bills that they see are obsolete or need to be, or the rules that are obsolete and need to be tweaked. So we have that there, but I do understand there's some concern that not all the agencies are doing that. So I'm just wondering why maybe not the approach of maybe beefing up 14.05 to make sure that the agencies are bringing forward those existing obsolete rules to fix and kind of following up on that wasn't, did you think about doing it that way instead?
Representative Joaquin, sounds like a great bill.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm asking.
Chief author in waiting?
Sure.
Representative
Mr.
Green.
Chair and Representative, I think that's what this does. I think that's exactly what this does. We're bringing the bills. They're going to have to tell us. They're going to have to show us the bills, the authority that they have. They're going to show us the rules and where they get the authority. This is exactly what we're doing, is what you're talking about.
Representative Joaquin.
Follow up. Actually, this bill does a lot more than that. And that's maybe you heard some concerns from the agency, and I share those concerns that there's a problem in there with specificity. There's a problem with retroactivity. And the specificity is a concern to me. We had this issue quite a few years ago when they were trying to control synthetic drugs, and the chemists couldn't keep up with the folks that were being really creative to create these drugs. So every time they put something into rule on a different chemical, they'd have to go back and change that rule. Otherwise, we couldn't enforce the law. So that there's an issue with that, and we all know we're a part-time legislature. We put laws into effect, and then we leave. And then we expect the agencies and the judicial branch and public safety to enforce those laws. And there's a lot of times around here that we craft a law to try to avoid unintended consequences, but we also many times make them vague so that they can be flexible. And we count on rulemaking to help put those laws into effect. So I really worry that you're taking away a large part of an agency's flexibility to actually make sure that they're following our intent when we're not here the other half of the year. So, well, I'm a little concerned about that, and I just wanted to throw that out there. Thanks.
Representative Green, I have no other questions. If you want to make some final comments before I lay the bill over.
Okay. I was actually pretty excited about this bill. I think it covers the bases. I don't think that there'll be a problem with the expedited rules. If there is an emergency, they still have that authority, and so I'm hoping that this will survive the process and we'll see it in a bill.
Representative Green, thank you. I will leave our House File 552 for future consideration. We're going to now move to House File 1433, Representative Kreisha. And Members, as Representative Kreisha is coming to the testifying table, I'll take this opportunity to share a little bit about what next week looks like. We will be meeting all 3 days next week, and I'm going to ask members to hold open Tuesday and Wednesday evenings in their schedule as well. More details to follow. We are starting to bridge that time of the session. As veteran members of this committee know, our time is much in demand toward the second half of the session than it is during the first half of the session. So, again, just some preliminary information as we're looking to put the calendar together. And with that, Representative Kreisha, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1433 before the committee to be laid over for future consideration. Representative Kreisha, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that is not unlike what you've seen today as well as last session when I offered it. It's very similar. We've made a bit of some changes to clarify some things, but essentially what this does is just helps put some governance over the rulemaking process and put some checks and balances for the legislature with the executive branch. And some people are going to talk about this in a more technical fashion than I, and if you'd like House nonpartisan staff to review a top line, that's fine too. I would just introduce this by saying we're the legislative branch, and we should make sure that our intents are held to the standards that we want them to be when they go to the rulemaking process. I understand where the executive branch would be interested in what they're doing, but they're not the legislative branch. We are. And we hear this all the time when we go back to our communities about why was this done, why was this done. And we've made a law, we've got it signed, and then we see it taking these other directions. And we should have the ability to put checks and balances there. We should have the ability to advocate for our constituents and not lose control through the rulemaking process. What you're going to hear is, which I always find is interesting because, again, we are the legislative branch, but the administrative branch will lobby against this. When I have to remind you that we're the legislative branch, this is what we do. And so I'm asking us to be thoughtful and to pull some of that back, and you're going to hear the executive branch come in and say, well, we really want that control. And that's the fight you're going to have in front of you today. So with that, I don't know if nonpartisan research would like to give a top line. They could probably do it better than I do.
Mr. Kering, are you willing to take maybe a few moments to run through some of the things?
And we can just say awesome and move on, but I'll let you do whatever you got to do.
Mr. Kering, I suspect you're not going to start with that word, but go ahead.
You don't know. Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Kreisha, yeah, so there is a bill summary in your packet, so maybe just in the interest of time, I won't go through section by section for every section of the bill unless you'd like me to do that. But just to highlight a few of the changes, one of the more substantial changes in this bill is that there's a process existing that allows the LCC and also this committee, the Government Operations Committee, to object to rules. And Section 1 of the bill expands the conditions under which the committee could object. So right now, the committee is authorized under current law to object to an existing rule if it's beyond the procedural or substantive authority delegated to an agency. And then this bill would expand that to also allow objections, among other reasons, if the committee believes that the rules are unnecessary or redundant, or if they have a substantial economic impact, which is defined in the bill. The committee could object if the rules are not based on a sound, reasonably available scientific, technical, economic, or other information, the rules are not cost-effective, or they're unduly burdensome, or they're more restrictive than a standard that's provided by federal law. So all of that process is contained in Section 1 of the bill. Another kind of highlight of the changes here is a definition of substantial economic impact. Again, this it appears throughout the bill, and effectively what happens here is that the bill is providing a definition of substantial economic impact and then allowing the committee to review rules that would have a substantial economic impact. There's a process where these types of issues could be referred to the legislative auditor, who would convene a panel to review whether a proposed rule has an impact that meets this definition, and then there's a process, a sort of back-and-forth process to review whether those types of rules should be adopted or not. And there's a process where a rule that does have a substantial economic impact might need to be approved by law if that condition is found. There's some miscellaneous changes related to the content and sort of the organization of statements of need and reasonableness that are contained in the bill. There's some other sort of things I described, maybe a little bit more than technical, but kind of technical and miscellaneous changes sort of related to a public hearing process and some other more narrow procedures of the Administrative Procedures Act. Mr. Chair, I think I will probably leave it at that for now, and I can talk about specific questions if members have questions about those.
Mr. Gearing will be available for questions. Representative Kreisha, back to your bill.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, one quick change, and this is a very technical thing that we caught in the last minute here. On line 4.21, beginning of that line is reference. The sentence should actually read, starting on 4.20, after the comma, the reviewing authority must independently and without deference. Should have been deference, but I'm sure everyone caught that, so I'm just make sure we get that cleared up now.
Representative Kreisha, we will take that into consideration because we are laying the bill over, but that is a good item for us to be able to take a ponderance on at some point in the future. Representative Kreisha, you have a testifier. Would you like to hear from him at this point? Welcome. If you'd like to testify, or excuse me, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Coolis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I know you've got a couple other folks that'd like to comment on this, and so I will be brief, but thank you for the time to allow me to testify in support of House File 1433. Mr. Chairman, I think you've heard a couple of bills today that have kind of put the crux of the issue up together is of what the legislative intent is when you pass rules and law or pass laws and what the implementation is of those laws by the state agencies when you allow them to do that. And I think the balance here is trying to figure out whether we allow state agencies, how do they go through and implement these laws and the legislative oversight, still keeping that legislative oversight. To also go through and allow the public participation, but to make sure that it's cost effective for the state agencies. And finally, to make sure to ensure industry compliance, but also not to add too much regulatory burdens to industries or cities that have to follow these rules. Mr. Chairman, this debate has been around for a while. I think you've heard about it. Some of us that have been around have remember the Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules. They were 1974. They've been abolished in 1996. In 2000, we had the Legislative Rules Reform Task Force to look at this issue. But this has been an ongoing debate. And even going back to 2014 and working with Representative Nelson, who authored the bill, and Representative Kreshaw to go through, we were approached by state agencies to go through and kind of update this rulemaking process. And Representative Kreshaw touched on one issue where if you are a chief author of a bill or a committee chair and you have and it requires rulemaking under the law currently, you are supposed to get the SONAR, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. Sometimes they can be three-ring binders, and I am pretty sure that you do not want them, Mr. Chairman, or some of the other authors to go through and see those, but they are big three-ring binders. But those are some of the things that we go through and update, or some of the agencies have asked us to look at. The other one is, do we still need to personally mail? Can we email things now that have, to go through and mail public notices? So we were approached in 2014 to work with the state agencies. They had some proposals. We have had some proposals to look at and update this system, and so we've been working with Representative Nelson and Representative Kreshaw. They both had great open-door policies. They've involved a lot of the stakeholders, whether they be cities, agricultural communities, the business community, to try and find the sweet spot here, Mr. Chairman. But I look forward to keep working with Representative Kreshaw and Representative Nelson as this moves through the process. I'm around every day, Mr. Chairman, and I know you've got some other folks that you'd like to get on record today.
Before we move to the other testifiers on the list, Representative Freiberg has a question. Representative Freiberg.
I'm just wondering, you said this sort of streamlines the process. As I'm reading this, particularly in Section 15 here, ultimately legislative approval is required, but Section 15 sets out this very elaborate process with an advisory panel of people who get paid by the agency and have to come up with this recommendation based on scientific evidence. I guess in theory that's fine. However, we just concluded the regent selection process yesterday. And I think as we saw through that, we can create this Byzantine process, but then in the end, when legislative approval is required, the legislature just kind of ends up doing whatever it wants. So I guess I'm wondering, why do you need to have all this in here if ultimately it's just going to be up to the legislature?
Representative Freiberg, is that to the author, to the testifier, or
either one,
whoever wants to take it?
Yeah.
Well, if nobody wants to take it, then what do I do? I can take it. To
bill out there, Representative.
So, I thank you for bringing that up. Let me just talk in process. I'm glad you brought the regions up. We're the legislature. We're elected to do our job. I'm going to bring up the regions process. We had a couple House members who are now senators who made a mockery of what we did last night. They offered people up that were, I mean, they just completely made a mockery of that. I'm trying to bring this back to what we do, which is making rules and respecting what people do and doing this the right way, and it falls on our shoulders. That's our accountability. If we want to send the accountability off into Never Never Land and then just go back to our areas and say, oh, you know what, it happened in rulemaking, I lost my authority on this, I think that's wrong. I think this should come back to us, and we should be accountable to our people and not make a mockery of some of these things that happen. So that's what I would offer.
Representative Freiberg, follow up.
Yeah, I'm not going to defend any action taken by a senator here.
First, let's keep personality.
I mean, ultimately, even
discussion.
Yeah, even if you set aside those nominations there, you know, ultimately what you had was this very elaborate process put into place with a body that made recommendations to the legislature, and then those in a couple cases those recommendations were just essentially ignored. So I mean, I just don't see what's in this bill to prevent that from happening.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Gehring can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding we talk about, Representative Kreischer talks about legislative attention bringing it back to us, but I believe under the current rulemaking process we have that, and there's different levels of it depending on how we do it. The previous bill talked about, my brain just went dead on that, but one part of that where that only happens if we allow them to use that process of rulemaking. But under all the rulemaking processes, if we as the legislature do not like a rule that's been promulgated, we have the right to pass legislation and eliminate that rule or change that rule. Is that correct, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Gehring, to the question by Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, that's correct. So the legislature has the authority to repeal existing rules if it chooses to. There's also a legislative authority in Chapter 14 for a committee with substantive matter jurisdiction over a rule to delay its implementation if it's still in the proposed stage. And then we've also already talked a little bit about the process for this committee or the LCC to object to existing rules.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not going to go on long, but this, like I said, there are some things that, looking at this, that may make some sense and maybe need some more tweaking, which we can always do. But I think we already have this authority to overlook these rules because that's our authority. But when we pass legislation, sometimes complicated pieces of legislation, we can't get every little thing and every little instance that might happen, and that's what the rulemaking process is for. And we pass that legislation and let the agencies that have to implement that, give them the flexibility to be able to write those rules so that they can implement the laws that we pass. We'd be here a long time if we had to think about every one of those and have the hearings of all the public hearings that are held in the rulemaking process to be able to make sure we tweak those and we get those right and not have problems with that. So,
Mr. Chair. Just in the interest of time, we have 12 minutes left. Sure. We have five testifiers, and we need to be done by noon with this matter. Representative Kreischer.
I'll make sure they all have at least 15 seconds to testify. I'm going to give you a quick illustration. And Representative Nelson, you bring up good points, and we talked about this. I go back to the legislative authority but that we have in our intent. But let me give you a quick illustration of why I'm charged to do this again. We passed the MTA 1066 telecom re-regulation bill last year. That in that bill, there was a section there that said that, I believe it was the PUC, and I'm sorry, my memory may fail me, but the PUC,
I've got one right here.
Or not the PUC, it was the Telecom Department of Commerce. They had 90 days to approve an application. Okay, so my intent, and what we all agreed upon was, once it got started, and once the paperwork was submitted, they had 90 days. Well, lo and behold, in July, I get notification back from the administrations, and their lawyer said, no, we interpret it, and that was the words, we interpret it as, we have 90 days from when the application is fully complete and in our hands. No. The intent was to close the process down in 90 days. So now, to your point, I have to go back and
find a way to deal with this legislatively when they specifically went around our intent that we agreed upon. So you're right. We can go back and we can do new legislative things, but we know how arduous that process is. We know how much of a pain in the neck it is when it's our intent that should be considered when it goes through, and we should have some feedback on that and be able to give direction on what our legislative intent is. And I'll be honest, I'm not here to advocate for the Department of Administration or rulemaking. I'm here to advocate for us to take our legislative intent so we can represent the people that, as we said we would.
The first testifier who has signed up, and I apologize if I pronounced the last name incorrectly, but Lily Tahiti? Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, and I'm hoping that we can maybe give you a minute or two to be able to share your thoughts, if that's all right with you.
I'll go as quick as I can, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Layli Fadahi, and I represent the Friends of the Mississippi River, a leading citizen-based organization that works to protect and enhance the Mississippi River and its watershed. I'm also an attorney, and I've taught broadly in the area of administrative law at the University of Minnesota. In the past, we've seen bills that seek to speed up and to reduce the requirements of rulemaking so that regulated entities get an answer faster and with fewer hurdles, often we hear. I mean, that's what it is that the regulated entities are looking for. This bill, however, takes a very interesting approach to solving this problem, one that I'm taken to referring to as deregulation by overregulation. And what it does is it imposes massive, time-consuming, and expensive hurdles that the agency has to go through, not only to adopt a rule, but even to just propose a rule, and then makes it so that even after going through all of these hurdles, the rule still has to be enacted by law. And I think the density and the complexity of the bill really serves the proponents' goals of obfuscating what it is that the bill actually does. And what it does is it gives individual legislative committees unchecked authority to block an agency from adopting or even holding public hearings for a proposed rule. It imposes requirements that the economic impacts of a proposed rule be assessed, but also mandates that the calculations include a growingly remote and set of unrelated costs, but then excludes also mandatorily any consideration of any direct economic benefits that might stem from a proposed rule. And then it uses this skewed economic impacts analysis to trigger requirements for additional reviews and approvals that come with significant delays and add millions of dollars of expense to the rulemaking process. It says that if the agency's determination of costs end up not being high enough to trigger these requirements, the bill has mechanisms that guarantee that they can be triggered anyway. And then once these requirements are inevitably triggered, it allows for a review by a 5-person peer review panel that's convened by the legislative auditor that's charged with determining the soundness of the proposed rule's scientific, technical, and economic basis. But the bill doesn't require that there be any qualifications or expertise for somebody to serve on this panel other than a one-sided exclusion of anybody that has direct or indirect knowledge of the agency's work, and yet the panel is supposed to make scientific, technical, and economic assessments. And then finally, the bill provides that the proposed rule can't take effect anyway unless it's enacted by law. I think really perhaps the only part of the bill that really clearly demonstrates what the point is of going through all of this just to have the legislature act is the amendment it makes in Section 2 that amends the language of the state's regulatory policy to make maximum flexibility for the regulated party the absolute non-comparative condition and goal for agency rulemaking. So I urge this committee to really take the time to unpack what it is that this rule is doing and to ask, whether the best way to deal with reining in the costs and delays of rulemaking is really to just force it to collapse under its own weight. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Steve Ring, followed by Mr. Kirk Kudelka, again from the PCA. You're following Mr. Ring. Mr. Ring, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Ring. I'm here as a volunteer on behalf of the Sierra Club North Star chapter. Within the chapter, I chair the Waters and Wetlands Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to briefly share some of our concerns about House File 1433. State agencies, such as the Pollution Control Agency, are responsible for protecting the health of our water, air, and communities. When the agency signs off on a decision, whether it's a rule, standard, or issuance of a permit, the public assumes that a fair and well-considered decision is being made in the best interest of the environment. House File 1433 creates new mechanisms for the legislature to delay or block new environmental rules from being implemented. Environmental rules and regulations are based on science. Our public agencies are the best equipped to review and interpret that scientific data and the consensus from it, and apply it to public interest without bias. The legislature itself recognized this in establishing a process for agency rulemaking in the first place. In addition, in the section of the bill that defines substantial economic impact, there's no discussion of benefit analysis. There are actual economic benefits that clean and healthy environments provide, and dirty environments can have actual economic costs. Also, a note about federal context. Many of our environmental rules and standards are closely interwoven with long-established federal laws, such as the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. Making significant changes to our state rulemaking process now, at the start of a new administration, and with unprecedented levels of uncertainty about where our federal agencies are heading, would be premature at best and irresponsible at worst. Nothing is perfect, and we are open to a conversation about how to improve the transparency, efficiency, and effectiveness of the rulemaking process as it relates to our environmental agencies. But any such changes should be done cautiously, with meaningful involvement from all stakeholders, and with a clear focus on outcomes that Minnesotans care deeply about: clean air, clean water, a safe and healthy environment. We are concerned that this bill will needlessly block and delay environmental regulation and basically make government less efficient and effective at fulfilling its responsibility to its citizens. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address your committee with our concerns.
Mr. Ring, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Gdelka, and then Mr. Marks is on deck after him. Welcome back to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Gdelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm here on behalf of all agencies in addition to the agency with our concerns in opposition to the bill. Just a quick highlight that rulemaking is given the agencies to work out the details of the overall policy set by the legislature. There is the resources there for the subject matter experts to get into the details that there is not the time available for the legislature. And we start all rulemakings because of the direction of the legislature. And this includes things such as workplace safety standards. DHS works on mental health facility standards, Department of Agriculture, meat inspections, and Department of Health drinking water standards. Each of those have rulemakings to dive deeper into the details at the request of the legislature. It was mentioned also the legislature has multiple ways to be involved with rulemaking and provide oversight. And so I won't go over each one of those, but it starts from the very beginning on the authority to grant rulemaking to the end and being able to pass a law that would repeal a rule that it believes is not following the direction that it set forth. In addition, the Office of Administrative Hearing provides a number of checks and balances on agencies fulfilling a crucial judicial review process. And finally, Minnesota has a very complex and process-heavy rulemaking procedure. Already more oversight is in rulemaking in Minnesota than other states. Let's compare this to other states in the federal model, where they are only required to appropriate notice, provide the authority that they have for the rules, and make sure they stay within that rulemaking authority, but then has a standard of arbitrary and capricious. Minnesota goes one better and has a standard of whether or not there's a need for and a reasonableness of the rule, which is a much higher bar to pass in other locations. So with those items already in place, here are some of our concerns with the legislation. Under the bill, costs trump all other concerns: consumer protection, human health, privacy issues when looking at the merits of a proposal. It equates any proposed rule that costs on average $1 per Minnesotan a year as bad and puts a stop to it unless both bodies of the legislature is able to pass it. When looking at cost, it doesn't consider how one sector of the economy may be affected in the other, regulations on financial institutions to protect consumers and businesses from fraud. It doesn't consider short-term versus long-term gains, for instance, protecting the health and viability of our game and fish populations and the long-term desire for that for the state. It doesn't factor in benefits of the other side of ledger, social or environmental costs, drinking water, food protection, safeties, where there isn't a dollar amount that can be assigned to it to offset the $5 million number in the bill. It also depends on both bodies of the legislature having time to approve the law. There are a number of good laws each year that not advance because there's not time for the legislature to agree on the issue. I mentioned earlier the Office of Administrative Hearings. This bill creates a duplicative and redundant process that increases costs and draws out the timeline. It creates a new process with the OLA that mirrors many of the same things that the Office of Administrative Hearing does and does it at the same time. For example, the Office of Administrative Hearing already can hold public hearings and takes testimony from interested parties. It determines whether the agencies have met that high threshold of need and reasonableness of a rule. It also looks at whether an agency's proposal is more restrictive than federal regulation and if it fits within its sidewalls of the authority that was given to it by the legislature. In addition to rulemaking, the proposed bill talks about enforcement of guidance, policy, bulletins, and other materials and creates another set of system for it. When already the Office of Administrative Hearings has that ability for a person to challenge whether or not an agency has done unpromulgated rulemaking, we question why the need for the change. Where did the system not work for the 40 cases since 1986 that have been brought before the Office of Administrative Hearings? During that time, the Office of Administrative Hearings has been very clear when an agency has overstepped its bounds. It has not been, it's been an effective check and has not rolled over for agencies, but instead made sure that concerns of agency overreach were adequately addressed. We have concerns about the constitutional separation of powers by giving the legislature the ability to veto rules. Governor Pawlenty and Dayton have both vetoed bills with legislative approval of rules in them. In addition, it alters the checks and balances between the two legislative bodies. As mentioned earlier, under 14.126, the two bodies, if the standing committees agree, say, for instance, on an environmental issue, the two environmental committees, they can delay a rules implementation until the end of the next legislative session. This creates a situation where only one committee can do so. So if a legislature, say today, directs an agency to move forward with a rule which they understand may be more stringent than the federal regulation or may have some costs but is needed, and they get both bodies of the legislature to approve that and the governor's signature, 3 years down the road when the agency is in the process of implementing it, one committee can overrule those decisions of the larger legislature and the governor. In addition, it tips the balance in favor of those who might challenge a change to the rule. What about the parties that are seeking a rule change? The provision allows an automatic stay, a hearing with limited requests and timeline problems, and it seriously disadvantages the members of the public that may benefit from the change. In addition, we have some concerns about how some of these timelines work out. The additional process ranges from 200 and some days to more for these processes to play out. At the same time, the agencies are already under certain requirements to meet 100-day thresholds. If we miss those 100-day thresholds, we have to start over the rulemaking again from the beginning, which is a waste of time and resources and also does not get to the certainty that many folks in the public are asking for in the rules. So in closing, agencies have focused on increased efficiency in carrying out our duties. We've improved our timelines for doing our work and are also reducing the cost. But this bill goes in the opposite direction by creating a duplicative process and increasing timelines and costs at little added value. We believe in some cases the bill would even stop important proposed public safety, health protection, worker and financial safeguards as a result. We believe the more effective approach is to focus on existing and proposed rules that raise concerns. Let us have a discussion of those. We can work on, if it's early in the process, changing the rulemaking to address those concerns, or if rules are already passed through legislation, other mechanisms, or new rulemaking. Thank you for the opportunity to share the agency's thoughts on the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Delka, thank you for your testimony today. We'll have Mr. Daniel Marks, and then the last person that I have who has signed up is Mr. Kevin Ruther.
And if there's members of the public that would like to speak on the matter, please see James, and we'll get you in the queue here before we wrap up the meeting today. Mr. Marks, welcome to the committee. I invite you to go ahead and share your name for the record and proceed with your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This afternoon, excuse me, we've already crossed past the noon hour.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Daniel Marks, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Flaherty & Hood, and work with a host of municipal organizations, including the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And we have significant experience working in agency rulemaking, particularly with the Pollution Control Agency. And we have had significant concerns with respect to the misuse or imprecise science used in rulemaking and the failure of the agencies to really perform in a meaningful way the cost study provisions that are required in existing law under Chapter 14. And then we have had significant concerns with the agency's use of guidance documents to implement rules without going through the notice and public comment rule process. We are in general support of this legislation because we think that it presents a common sense and a reasonable framework to address a lot of these concerns at the front end of rulemaking. And just particularly the pieces that we are most interested in, one is on line 414 related to the limitation regarding certain policies, guidelines, and other interpretive statements. I think that is an essential component of this legislation, particularly with our experience dealing with guidance documents from the Pollution Control Agency. Additionally, we are appreciative of the peer review process that is set forth in line 10.1. We think that having this peer review process to look at the scientific issues and the financial issues, the cost impact issues, is essential. And we have been concerned at the level that that analysis has been performed under the current Chapter 14 procedures that the agencies go through. Now, with respect to that, there are some components of that that we might like to work with Representative Crenshaw and the legislature to improve with regard to kind of the specific scientific review. And then we would also like to work to ensure that peer review process is open to public comment on the charge questions that peer review panel would review. And then, you know, with respect to the definition of substantial economic impact, again, we think that that is a reasonable threshold to trigger this additional analysis. But we would like to see and work with the legislature to kind of better define significant economic impact with respect to local governments. I think the current language is not particularly clear, so it might be something that we would work with all of you on. So, again, I think that this is a reasonable approach to address some of what are concerns in agency and regulatory overreach that we have experienced in recent years, and we are generally supportive of the legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Marks, thank you. I have the last testifier who has signed up, and then I've had one member of the public identify themselves, and then we'll go to if there's any member questions. Mr. Ruther, you will come forward, please. And then I believe the name is Nora Felton. If you will come and just be in the queue spot here, we'll get you going this morning as well. Mr. Ruther, if you will, go ahead and introduce yourself. I don't want to put pressure on you, but the committee is 10 minutes over today, and I always know batting cleanup is always a difficult thing to do in committee. So I don't want to pressure, but I also want to be respectful of your time and others as well today, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Ruther. I'm the legal director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCEA. MCA's attorneys work closely with the agencies in administrative proceedings. We also work in the courts, and we're very familiar with administrative rulemakings and generally the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. I do have actually substantial prepared comments that I'm just going to skip given the time.
But Ruther, if you want to, just for the record, you can get those to our committee administrator, and we will enter those into the record so that they, even though you might not have a chance to verbally testify, they will be a part of the written record if you would like to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have them cleaned up a bit and submitted electronically. I just want to mention, however, that we brought with us today a letter from two law professors, one from the University of Minnesota, one from William Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, who teach in the administrative law area, both objecting to this bill and urging its rejection. And they set out a number of reasons for that. One of those has to do with federal preemption and the fact that this law likely would get Minnesota in trouble with some federal laws. And the example that's cited in the letter is the Clean Water Act. And so part of my prepared remarks were to talk about that and explain that. And I would just, I guess, invite any of you as you're working through this bill. It's a big bill, makes lots of major changes. If you have questions about it, again, MCA and our attorneys, we're very familiar with it, and we'd invite those questions.
Mr. Ruth, I do apologize for the brevity of your need to make comments today, but certainly, again, get your written comments to the administrator, and we will get those into the record.
Thank you.
And with that, Ms. Felton, if you'd like to come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed. And then I have one member question, and we can go with others if we have them after that. Ms. Felton, thank you for joining us today.
My name is Nora Felton, and honestly, I did not plan on doing this today. I'd come to an earlier hearing, but I've been familiar with some of the stuff that you and Representative Pugh have been working on the last few years. I come as a business owner and a farmer who has been under the scrutiny of these regulations as they come through, these rules that provide a 30-day notice for us that are supposed to be stakeholders to be able to make comment and such when we're trying to plant, harvest, and otherwise. I have been to meetings where the room is filled with 95 people from these agencies and three farmers. I have been to these meetings and begged that as a stakeholder that the meetings be held at a time and a place where we actually could give input. I have been told that it doesn't work with the scheduling at the agencies. I have lived under the expanding authority that the agencies have taken for clean water or buffer zones, how it changes on a almost daily basis. We were told that the maps would be ready for buffer zones, for example. We should check those, make sure they're correct, give input. Now we find out that this is just an ongoing thing, and if we don't get back to them in 30 days, it could be forever that that piece of land is taken as a buffer strip or deemed not to be in compliance. I have seen what it costs for some of these regulations if they deem that somehow or another we are uncompliant. And all I'm going to say is this. There are fewer and fewer of us farmers, and there are even fewer business owners in the state of Minnesota. When my sister, who is a business owner, goes to tax meetings to try to find out what she needs to do for taxes and employment in this state, and there's a panel of 10 people, and she asks a question, and they buffer it back and forth and say, well, I don't know, that's not my area in the agency, and then they laugh. I want you all to think about the amount of power you've given these agencies over us. And if you really want anybody left in business or anybody left out here to feed you, and that's my testimony. Thank you.
Ms. Felton, thank you. You don't usually do this on a regular basis, but you had knocked it out of the park with your testimony today. It is not easy for people who don't do this as a living to get up here. Thank you for taking your time as a citizen to be with us today. I have one member question, Representative Joaquin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are going to be laid over, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot more work done on them. And I want to thank Ms. Felton for coming up and speaking. She brought up a really good point about public input. I do worry if we're bringing this all the way back to the legislature every single time that lessens the public input instead of being out in the community like rulemaking and agency bodies can be. That being said, it sounds like there is a lot of work to be done. There's some distrust. It's been 3 years back and forth between how we do this, and I applaud Representative Creasia for taking this on. Just want to leave you with some quick parting thoughts just as you're moving through the process. We talk about, in a previous bill, they talked about rulemaking adding cost to the process. Well, I think this adds cost to the rulemaking process, which then it's like a vicious circle, which adding cost to everybody else. So especially on page 10, you have paying a panel, more administrative law judges. So just kind of keep that in mind as you're adding cost to the rulemaking process. You're then adding cost to the folks that are affected by the rules. We set laws up here. Our executive branch is supposed to administer them, and the courts enforce them, so there's a balance, and I just want to make sure that we're maintaining the balance as we're moving through this process. And then also, some of these bills that we've been introducing in a lot of our different committees seems to keep pushing us towards almost what would be a full-time legislature. If we keep putting stuff into the purview of the legislature, we are going to end up giving ourselves more work, and I just kind of want you to think about that, too. So just my 2 cents. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin, thank you. Seeing no other public testimony and no other member questions, I will lay over House File 1433 for future consideration. We are adjourned.